One of the things, David, that has raised its ugly head, and I call it ugly intentionally, in the 21st century, of course it was back in the 20th as well, and that is this multiculturalism. And how has this affected the culture? Because the multicultural madness, we throw Bill and Hillary Clinton in there because they're a part of it, it's altered many institutions, from government to the media to the education and even faith. This multiculturalism, it has changed America. It has turned us upside down.
Well, Jan, you know, again, multiculturalism is one of those things that appears to be one thing but actually is something else. Like, you know, let's just say the word multiculturalism. Your listeners are listening to that word. What comes to mind? What we assume is that, you know, kids go to school, they go to college, and they're taught about other cultures. They're taught about Chinese culture, about Indonesian culture, and African culture, and they're taught about the way other people think, and about their cultural and scientific and other achievements, and that this helps us to understand our you know, fellow travelers in the world, and it broadens us. And you know what? If that's what multiculturalism was, it'd be great. I'd love to have my kids learn all that and to understand other, even philosophies and cultures they don't agree with. It's great to understand the world.
But that's not how it's played out.
That ain't what multiculturalism about at all. Let's look at the groups, first of all. First of all, your kids don't learn about Chinese culture and Indonesian culture. What they learn about is all the groups that supposedly have been oppressed by evil white European Christian men. So we're talking about gay and lesbian culture, black studies, Hispanic studies, women's studies, Native American studies, nothing wrong with these people per se. It's fine to learn about that, but the culture of it, the intent behind it is, as Judge Robert Bork has said in his book, Slouching Toward Gomorrah, is that multiculturalism has become a battering ram for beating down Western civilization, for putting it down. In other words, this is not about elevating other cultures. This is about denigrating and putting down Western Judeo-Christian culture. Mm-hmm. That's what it's really all about, folks. And if you doubt me, you need to go and set a few steps onto any modern secular university campus and go to orientation day in the first week and listen a little bit. It's not like it was when you went to school 20, 30, 40 years ago.
But how is multiculturalism then being marketed, as you say?
Well, you know, marketing is a metaphor for seduction. In other words, it's being sold to us, and the idea that we are, well, let's take an example to bring it down to earth on this marketing and how it hurts us. Okay, let's take what Daniel Pipes calls sudden jihad syndrome.
Yes,
this
I want to go there. Go ahead. That's a good place to go.
Yeah, this is where about, you know, every so often we have a Muslim who goes and opens fire on a bunch of Jews in this country, let's say. Like whether it's the LAX at the airport, you know, the Egyptian cabbie goes into the El Al, you know, the Israeli terminal there and shoots people. And what do we hear from the media? Oh, we hear every conceivable and some inconceivable explanation that, you know, he was frustrated over this. It must have been marital problems. It may have been kind of medication he was on. Everything except that he was like a jihadist freelancer that was angry at Israel, angry at Jews, angry at America for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he decided to go and kill some Jews. We don't hear that. Even the Beltway sniper,
right?
Okay, these people terrorized the greater Washington D.C. area for 3 weeks, killed a dozen or more people, and for crying out loud, the lead sniper was a Muslim who changed his name to Muhammad. I mean, duh, as my kids say. But still, I have it in my book, there were six different explanations that the Los Angeles Times advanced for why John Muhammad had gone and just cold-bloodedly killed all these people in Washington, D.C. None of them, I repeat, none of them had to do with Islam or jihad or the fact that he was known to have sympathies for the 9/11 terrorists and so forth. Now, okay, this goes to the media matrix and the news media, but it's symptomatic of the whole problem of what we call political correctness. Nobody wants to go and criticize Islam. Islam is a culture. It's a belief. It's a philosophy. It's a religion. And it means certain things. And just saying it's a religion of peace does not make it a religion of peace. There are peaceful Muslims, but the fact is there are literally millions of people of that faith who have been sucked into it and who are angry and who basically seethe with a rage toward Jews, Christians, the West, America, Israel, and they believe what they're told, which is that we are enemies, we are infidels, and if they die killing one of us, they'll go straight to heaven and get the 72 virgins. And the fact that it's, you know, I wrote a column called The Invisible Jihad, and as I mentioned, Pipes, who talks about sudden jihad syndrome, it's making fun of this fact that not just the news media, but the government, even the FBI, mm-hmm. seem incapable of identifying that there are people in our midst who want to kill us, that are, you know, filled with this type of anger and this type of brainwashing belief that we are evil and that they can take advantage of our freedoms here, but that they have a duty to Allah to kill us. And this has to do with multiculturalism and political correctness, because we can't bring ourselves to say there is a problem with Islam. So even I guarantee even right now some of your listeners probably don't like hearing those words. There is a problem with Islam in this country.
But what you are very right about, and by the way, your comment is very right as well, there is a problem with Islam, is that you don't find the truth about these issues very many places. We're not even hearing it all that much on Fox News. By the way, they're majoring in minors these days. They can't get off some of the nonsense topics.
Yes, it's true.
But you can find it on certain internet sites, such as WorldNet Daily, with whom you are affiliated with, and perhaps a little bit on talk radio. But basically, the culture and the traditional mainstream media, they're assisting greatly in this seduction.
No, you're exactly right, Jan. And what you just described when you said the internet and talk radio, that's often called the new media, mm-hmm. In distinction to the old media or the main. It's really not properly called the mainstream media, because that implies they're in the mainstream of what, you know, middle class America thinks, which they're just not.
They're not.
I call them the establishment media or the big media. There are lots of very good books. Dozens of excellent books on Islam now. But, you know, see, for every person that actually goes and buys the book and reads the book, there are hundreds or maybe thousands that just watch the TV, and they don't really get the distilled truth of the matter. You'd think, though, in this day and age, years after 9/11 and with all the warnings about terrorist attacks and all the rest of it, that would be a good topic to go and explore. I would encourage people to look into it, not to be afraid.
If you've just joined us, folks, I am talking this hour with David Kapelian, and he is managing editors of WorldNet Daily. That's worldnetdaily.com. His book is The Marketing of Evil, How Radicals, Elitists and Pseudo-Experts Sell Us Corruption Disguised as Freedom. David, I want to spend a little bit of time on your perception of how the church plays into this, and we can do that in just a couple of minutes here. But first of all, you know, I think when people are hearing a great big long list of such negative things, the first thing that comes to mind is, how can we change it? How can we make things right? and maybe we can't. The slippery slope always goes one way. I've never known the slippery slope to stop and turn itself right again. But do you have any answers?
You know, Jan, and this goes really to the last chapter of my book, which is about the Christian church, and I'd be happy to talk to you about it. There are a lot of books that have a kind of a laundry list of things that you can do. And I do have some of that in my book, things like specific things like if you have a problem with the public schools, don't send your kids to them. Homeschool them, which is what, you know, there, I know there are also private Christian schools. There are other options. My wife and I have homeschooled our kids, and we've been very glad that we did. So that's my experience. I do have specific sort of individual solutions in there, and there are some big national solutions, like on the divorce chapter. It's very obvious that no-fault divorce has been an utter disaster, and there are really a couple dozen states right now that are in the process of changing their divorce laws from no-fault divorce so that, for instance, if you have minor children, you can't just go, one spouse just go and file a quickie divorce. You have to undergo counseling. You have to wait a year before it can be completed, and so forth. So there are some solutions, but really, my book is not about a cookie cutter approach. Oh, mm-hmm. You have to take back local government. You have to. Those things have all been said before, and if they were going to work, they would have worked already. What I'm focused on is the individual. We are seduced away from our God-given self individually, and we find salvation individually. It's not a group activity. And I am, from my perspective, I'm focused on the individual. And really, that dovetails really nicely into what I'm saying about the churches, mm-hmm. because if you read the last page of the book, what I'm not saying is now, you know, get huff and puff and get out there and join all these political action committees and do this. I'm for all that. But to be properly motivated and to really find what God has for you specifically, how he wants to channel you in terms of your life, including trying to make the big picture a little better, to make America, you know, a shine again, we really have to be right with God. Now, that's a big subject, but basically what I'm saying is that we need to, you know, as the good book says, we need to go into our closet, and I'll just change the metaphor a little bit. We need to look in the mirror, and we need to take a very, very hard and painful look at ourselves, because we're all very good at seeing the faults of other people. It doesn't take very much. It's actually the simplest thing in the world. But we're not good at seeing ourselves, because we're so used to us, we're so used to being the way we are, that we literally, it's like asking a fish about water. We just don't see what's wrong with us unless we're very, very sincere and really want to understand what's wrong with us and how we're affecting other people. And we need, as John said in, you know, 1 John in the Bible, we need to walk in the light, which is a very, you know, it sounds like, okay, what does that mean? Okay. Well, to me, what it means is you're walking in kind of honesty, your honest introspection. You know, you're cheerful, you're interacting with life, you're married, have kids, have a job, all the rest of that. I'm not talking about going living in a cave and contemplating your belly button all day. I'm just saying living a normal life, but we have to have this facet where we are really looking honestly, sincerely at ourselves, at our relationships, and repenting of what we see wrong with us. And that there is an entire new future, a new destiny that comes into play then. It's sort of like a track that we didn't even know existed when we do that. If we're just comfortable with all of our comforts and our distractions and everybody telling us how wonderful we are and you know, all the comforts that we surround ourselves with, which basically keep us, you know, anesthetized, keep us asleep, to the kind of things that God wants us to see and to help us to grow to be better people, then, you know, we're just sort of on autopilot.
David, you write and talk about the fact that the culture is under attack, And I'm like your take, too, because you do write about it, and how this has been marketed. I think this is a major target by the forces of darkness. And you talk about the merchants of cool. What are the merchants of cool? Who are they?
Well, that's referring to youth culture.
Yep.
And basically, I drew somewhat on a PBS documentary of that name, Merchants of Cool. In fact, if you Google it, you can probably watch the documentary. It's an hour documentary. It's brilliant online. But basically what it's talking about is how kids, talking about the MTV world and mm-hmm. all the music and the videos and the clothing and all that, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, how these kids are marketed to. And you're dealing with a target market that is unsophisticated, inexperienced, intelligent, yes, but inexperienced, and can, basically, if you know how to push their buttons, you can do it, and you can empty their pockets of a lot of their parents' money. And unfortunately, as I point out in the chapter in The Marketing of Evil, which is called Killer Culture, it's not just clever marketing, it is degrading and corrupting marketing, because as it happens, the way to get more money out of people, the way to get the loyalties out of kids in this current youth culture, is to create more and more shock value.
Yes.
It's just, you know how art used to be beautiful, and then at a certain point, art became whatever was more shocking became.
It's all I remember art. Is the fact that it's shocking.
Right? That's right. And so shock replaced inspiration, in a sense. Okay, now just take that away from art, and let's go to this youth culture. The more shocking, it has a feeling of being new and more exciting and somehow more authentic, something that's more shocking. It's perverted, but that's the way it's taken when you're in that state, in that heavily influenced, culturized, peer pressured, youth culture. You kind of never come up for air. You're going to public school. This is what you're around at school, in the mall, and on TV. And so, it's a little hard to explain in a short period of time, but it's a whole industry with people that are very well trained that literally spy on the youth to see what they're thinking about, what's in and what's out. And then they use that information against these kids to sell them the latest fashions, the latest music, the latest behaviors. And, if your listeners want to get a real, a real eyeful of this, turn on MTV for a while.
Mm-hmm.
There are some halfway decent shows. There are some absolutely awful shows on there. But you watch it for a while, and you'll see, what you'll see is that you don't want your kids watching this anymore.
Yeah. Well, so that explains the Merchants of Cool then. I mean, in a sense, you say that the media watches kids and then sells them an image of themselves.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's move on to the issue of Christianity, because, all right, we're seeing the culture sort of disintegrate, but the church has always been a staying hand in America, and I do believe it still is, though it's not as strong as it used to be, I believe. And you deal a lot with this, again, talking to David Kapelian and The Marketing of Evil, how radicals, elitists, and pseudo-experts sell as corruption disguised as freedom. But you say that on any given Sunday, 45% of Americans are attending worship services. And, of course, that doesn't mean that 45% are hearing a solid gospel. I'm afraid far too many are not. But you make a point that even Christians have been seduced by the marketers of evil. And why don't you explain what you mean by that?
Well, just look at the divorce rate.
Mm-hmm.
The Christians seem to have the same problems that non-Christians do. And if you see these very disturbing polls that George Barna comes out with year after year after year, Barna is a respected Christian pollster. Essentially what he says is that by any way he knows to measure it, born-again Christians just don't act much any differently than their heathen neighbors do. I mean, I can't say it any nicer than that. This is, if you go to his website and read, this is a guy who's cited by all mm-hmm. you know, people that are involved in and who are Christians who are engaged in the culture, who are aware of that, people like D. James Kennedy and Dobson and others who are not just, quote, preaching the gospel, will say, you know, we have a responsibility to proselytize not just the gospel, but to make it a better world. It's kind of like I quote Francis Schaeffer a lot in this last chapter of the book. And, you know, Francis Schaeffer, he wrote 26 books. He was one of the best-known evangelical philosophers of the last century. And he basically said this. He said, you're a Christian? Here's your responsibility. You're walking down the street. This is sort of a modern-day, you know, Good Samaritan parable. You're walking down the street. You see a little girl getting raped across the street by a 240-pound man. Your responsibility as a Christian is to cross the street immediately and do whatever you can to stop that attack, even if you lose your life. Now, that is, I don't think anybody listening would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what we actually do today is we're more likely to convene a prayer meeting and pray that the perpetrator has a change of attitude.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just being a little graphic here, but that is. Kind of, you know, that's my view of what would make this country better. Because look, you ask me how are Christians being marketed evil? A lot of this is just, how do I say this? It's just being put to sleep, just being made comfortable. You want me to say something dramatic, but some of it is just, you know, you're fine, you're saved. You're going to heaven. Stay home and watch your TV.
Well, that is the state of the church today, David. There's many who would disagree with that.
You know, let's put it this way. 80% of Americans, this is how I start the chapter, profess to be Christians. Now, that means 80% of voters. And yet, look at, you know, look at the kind of laws we have and the people we elect and the culture, the judiciary. Look at what we have in this country. It's not only unchristian, it's increasingly anti-Christian.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Look, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. There's something wrong with a lot of us Christians. And I want to say, because I am critical, the church, I am speaking to you as a Christian believer. And Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior and my hero, and I acknowledge Christianity is the hope of the world. So I want to, you know, I want my orientation clear here. But the fact is, there is something terribly wrong with the modern church, such as it is, which is not wrong with Jesus, not wrong with Christianity, but wrong with the institutions that we have today. And, you know, I kind of take a survey of it. I can take a little romp through the Christian world in that last chapter. It's the longest chapter in the book. And I
Very
go
good.
Through... look, you have the more obvious targets, right? You have the liberal churches. Let's face it. We have the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, and all the 30-some denominations, the big, what we call mainline denominations.
Well, there's a church for every kind of worldview, I mean, including the Metropolitan Church across America that exists for the gay,
right.
gay community. So there's a church for everybody that doesn't... A church is just a building, though. It's just a building.
If you're a liberal, there's a church for you. If you're a conservative, there's a church for you. If you are involved in politics, there's a church for you. If you believe that you should just, like, you know, I'm saved, I'm waiting for the rapture, and to heck with everybody else, there's a church for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you hate Jews, there's a church for you. If you love Jews and Israel, there's a church for you. I mean, we have, what, 2,000 Christian denominations now, something like that, and sub-denominations? It's remarkable. And they're all supposedly based on the same Bible.
Well, we've got, David, the Church of Latter-day Leftists. Now, that's what you call it, and frankly, so do I. I'm troubled that... I believe it was this week or else last week, the religious left went marching off to Iran. They visited Adolf Ahmadinejad and they had a cozy chat with him. And they visit Hamas and they visit Fatah and they come back and say, you know, Hamas is easier to deal with than Israel.
It's scandalous. See, it's and in fact, you mentioned Israel. We've had major churches, entire denominations that have insisted on investing their investments from Israel. In other words, making the comparison, the only time that's been done before is with South Africa during the World Campaign Against Apartheid. And they're comparing Israel, which is this tiny country that's so small I can't even find it on a map without putting my glasses on. To the Arab world, which has all of the land, all of the population, all of the oil, you know, all of the real estate, all of the riches, and somehow we, you know, Israel, it was like a little David compared to the Goliath of the Arab world, and somehow Israel is portrayed as being the Goliath that's cruelly lording it over the tiny little Arab world. This is certifiable, but this is we're not talking about fringe sects here. We're talking about, you know, mainline denominations, where I guess I should say we're not necessarily saying that all the followers of that denomination. We're talking about the leadership that are, you know, when the Presbyterian Church USA voted to divest from Israel, the vote was like 80 or 85% in favor of siding with the Palestinians against. It wasn't even close. It was almost unanimous.
Yeah, they did back down, you know.
Yeah, and they've since reversed that because they got so much heat for it. But, you know, this is, see, look, you forgive me, Jan. The problem, the disconnect we have is that we like to say, well, all these people are good people and they're saved and they're going to heaven and yet they happen to be wacko and they're filled with evil and they're making the world a worse place. I think there's something wrong with that. There was, D. James Kennedy, whom I love, he had a sermon a while back where he said, look around you. He has a very big congregation there in Florida. And he said, look around you. Okay, look to your left, look to your right. You got a lot of unsaved people who think they're going to heaven and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
That's a radical statement. But I think we need to wake up and realize that we're going to have some sanity in this conversation. We're going to have to understand that of the 80% of Americans who believe they're Christians and are going to heaven, there are a lot that are not. And I'm not saying this person is going to heaven, this person is not. I'm not God, okay? But I do know that the good book said, including Jesus said, that many will come in my name and will lead many astray, and I'll say, you know, I never knew you. And, you know, a lot of these people that I'm talking about, they also quote the same scripture. So,
right.
You know, you have to trust what you see. God shows you, but I'm not condemning anybody in particular, and I'm not saying anybody who's lost right now won't be found tomorrow.
Right.
But I am saying that the fact is there are a lot of phonies out there, mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that are discrediting Christianity and who are basically taking, you know, sincere, decent souls and are confusing them into abandoning Christianity. You say, if this is what Christianity is about, I don't want to have anything to do with it.
Right, but you feel, and so do I, David, talking to David Kapelian of WorldNet Daily, The Marketing of Evil, you and I both feel that our churches really are America's last hope, so to speak. And in Bible times, there were some nations that turned around. They had complete repentance. They repented so sincerely. They had the animals wear sackcloth and ashes. And I don't think that's going to happen in our generation. I just don't see it, as far as I can tell.
Well, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the churches. Barna wrote a book, I can't remember the name of it right now, but basically about why men are leaving the churches. You know which book I'm talking about? And he's just saying men go to churches, and he says, no thanks. This is like sort of like made for women. These are people from the corporate world who see things done very mm-hmm. competently, and they say, you know what, I'd rather home church. I'd rather do something else. God is not only in this building, okay? God is out there everywhere, and I can worship God, and I can find my salvation and find my path without going to a traditional church. And there are many people increasingly who are doing that. There's a whole home church movement, lots of books written about it and so forth.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating one thing or the other. I'm just saying that there are people who resonate with what you and I are talking about right now. This is not just a couple of kooks on the radio saying, well, there's something wrong with the churches. This is a very widespread phenomenon. A lot of people are just not happy going there and you know, going through the same songs and listening to some sermon that may or may not be inspiring to them and the same stuff. They say, wait a minute, there's more than this. And the truth is there is more than that.
All right, let me ask you one more thing in the interest of time, because of having read WorldNet on, I believe, Thursday, there's a big headline, Librarian Sues Gay Professor Over Marketing of Evil, at your book, A Christian Accused of Sexual Harassment for Recommending Best-Selling Book. What is this all about? We have only a very few minutes left.
Well, just in a nutshell, it was probably the stupidest and most amazing case of political correctness that I've ever seen, where a Christian librarian at Ohio State University Mansfield campus was brought up on formal charges of sexual harassment because he recommended my book, The Marketing of Evil, be required reading for the incoming freshmen. And specifically, there were a couple of openly gay English professors that took exception probably to the first chapter, because the first chapter basically deconstructs the whole gay marketing movement. They didn't like that. And the shame of it, we know there's all kinds of wacko professors here and there. The entire faculty voted 21-0 with 9 abstentions to back these gay professors.
Okay.
See, they're all afraid of being called bigots and homophobes.
Right, right.
So they went along with it. Later on, you know, the Alliance Defense Fund got involved, warned them that there is a such thing as the Constitution. You can't do this. The college backed down. And so now what happened last Tuesday is Scott Savage, this gentle little pious Quaker Christian librarian, is suing the professors that did this to him. And so that's the latest, and
right,
we'll see how that
so
turns out.
So this doesn't really – does it affect you then in any way? It's more of a campus issue?
Did it affect me?
Yeah.
Yeah, it made a lot of people buy my book.
All right.
When it happened, it drove my book up to number one on the Amazon current events list for a week and sold a lot of books, because a lot of people said if these college professors are so threatened by the idea that the freshman would have to read my book, maybe there's something good about it. Let's go read it.
Well, there is something good about it. Again, folks, the author is David Kapelian, who's been with me this hour, and the book is The Marketing of Evil, How Radicals, Elitists, and Pseudo-Experts Sell Us Corruption Disguised as Freedom. And if you have wondered, my listening audience, how America has been transformed so rapidly from a strong Judeo-Christian culture into a divided, confused, and contentious society, increasingly hostile to its own core values, then I would encourage you to get a hold of the book and understand the transformation that's been going on. As David said, going back to the 1800s, but probably more vociferously since that, the 1960s. David Kapelian, thank you so much for giving up some time and joining me today on Understanding the Times.
My pleasure, Jan.